Hello, everybody. Good afternoon, or good morning, I guess, depending on what part of the country you're in. Thanks for joining us today. My name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'm excited to be here moderating today's webinar on the impact of Rokitsky v. Clem on the ARM industry, which is being brought to you by TCN. The Supreme Court's decision in this case has the potential to dramatically alter how the statute of limitations is calculated with respect to alleged violations of the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. In this webinar, we've assembled a panel of leading compliance experts who are here to discuss the case and how it will reverberate throughout the ARM industry. This webinar is being generously sponsored by TCN. You'll get the chance to hear more about them a little later in our program. I did want to offer a special note of thanks to TCN. This webinar came about really late last week, and TCN jumped at the chance to be a sponsor, even though the amount of time to promote the event was considerably shorter than usual. I just think that this speaks to TCN's desire to help educate the industry on important topics, and I just wanted to thank them for their continued support on behalf of all of us listening today. I wanted to take a quick minute and also say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the ARM industry. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use, and it's a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you all spend a few minutes checking out what it has to offer. Let me tell you a little bit now about today's speakers. Kelly Knepper-Stevens is the Vice President of Legal and Compliance and the Associate General Counsel for True Accord. Her work focuses on government regulation, compliance, and civil litigation. Kelly serves on the board of directors for the Receivables Management Association International and is an ACA certified instructor. She was also involved in both the arbitration and debt collection rulemaking. Her podcast, Two Dedicated Attorneys, can be found on accountsrecovery.net. Joanne Needleman is the leader of the Consumer Financial Services Regulatory and Compliance Group at Clark Hill. She is the immediate past president of the board of directors of the National Creditors Bar Association and also served on the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's Consumer Advisory Board. Manny Neuberger leads the Consumer Financial Services Law Practice Group at Barron and Neuberger. He is known nationally for his expertise in consumer and commercial law, defending consumer litigation and regulatory matters across the country, and providing compliance advice and training across the globe. He has taught consumer protection law at the University of Texas Law School since 1999, and he is the author of books and articles covering a variety of consumer financial services laws. Scott E. Wortman is a partner at Blank Rome with a practice focusing on consumer financial services litigation, including individual and class action defense, regulatory proceedings, and administrative investigations. Additionally, he represents and counsels clients on corporate and regulatory compliance procedures in a wide variety of consumer financial areas. Scott is also a strategic advisor to fintech companies and other innovative and non-traditional financial services and technology firms. He's an active member of the New York State Bar Association, serving as chair of the Banking Law Committee and on the Executive Committee for the Business Law Section. The format for today's webinar will be a panel discussion. We encourage everybody to submit questions and we will get to them as the discussion is ongoing. To submit a question, please enter it in on the Q&A tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. This event is being recorded and a recording will be made available in the coming day, or actually probably by the end of the day, on accountsrecovery.net. Finally, I want to ask everybody to reserve a minute and to use that minute to fill out the survey that should pop up on your screen after the webinar is over today. You'll also receive a link via email tomorrow to access the survey. Your participation and your feedback helps me develop the content that is what you're looking for, such as the topic we have for you today, and to make sure we have the speakers you want to hear from, which is definitely the case we have for you today. So with that, let's launch into our discussion. Manny, since you're up on my screen right now, maybe you can start by providing a brief summary of what this case is all about and why we're talking about it today.
Sure, glad to do that. Let's start with the core concept of what is the discovery rule. The discovery rule is an exception to the statute of limitations. It's a rule that says even if the statute of limitations under its normal terms would have run, it's extended to begin to run from the date that the cause of action was discovered or through the exercise of reasonable diligence should have been discovered. By the way, that phrase, discovered or through exercise of reasonable diligence, should have been discovered, I do not think was ever actually uttered during the oral argument. In this case, the defendant was a law firm. They sued the plaintiff. Plaintiff alleges that the default was obtained without proper service. Lawsuit was not filed until a number of years later when Rutkiski allegedly learned for the first time of the default judgment and alleged that the suit against him violated the FDCPA. He essentially, by identifying the date of the wrongful conduct and asserting a claim under the FDCPA, did what we would call pleading himself out of court. He effectively negated his own suit by pleading a lawsuit that was on its face time barred, and at least in the original complaint, failed to plead any exceptions to the statute of limitations. He amended the complaint, as I understand it, but still didn't do a particularly good job. Lost the case based on limitations. It was appealed, it was affirmed, went to the Supreme Court. Although the court focuses on, I think, one Ninth Circuit case, there were actually a number of courts around the country that had held that the discovery rule applied in FDCPA cases. Given the split in circuit authority, the Supreme Court resolved the split, finding that there is no discovery rule in the FDCPA. Someone else may disagree with that summary. I'll give the other speakers a chance to jump in and tell me where I screwed it up.
Did anyone tell Manny he screwed it up?
Manny, you didn't screw it up.
I don't agree. Thank you, Joy. I still find it something of a mystery that the various appellate courts had, before this case, gone the other way. I can say that I watched at least one of the oral arguments in one of the earlier cases, and I can tell you that the issues were not properly preserved. Here they were.
Yeah, this is Scott, and I also was surprised. You know, when you look at the Fourth and Ninth Circuits, where they felt that the discovery rule applies to the FDCPA's one-year statute of limitations, and I had a case actually that was mentioned in the holding, the Benjamin against Citibank case in the Second Circuit, and in that case, it was never really brought as an issue because the case by the plaintiff was so weak to begin with. But it was determined that various courts, including the Second, the Fifth, and the Tenth, had declined to rule on the very issue of whether or not the discovery rule applies to the FDCPA.
This is Joanne. I'm not surprised that circuits have interpreted it that way. And I guess, again, this is what now, since the German case, what the sixth, maybe fifth or sixth or seventh FDCPA case that the Supreme Court has heard, and my numbers may be off a little bit, but we're seeing, and we've had two this year, you know, we're seeing time and time again, the best place for an FDCPA case is clearly the Supreme Court, because that is the only court that is correctly looking at the FDCPA for what it is. And that is a strictly construed, narrow statute that's pretty clear about what you can and cannot do. And that's what this, to me, this is what Thomas has really stated in this opinion, and was also similarly stated in the Obudzki case a couple months ago. It is so surprising to me how district court judges and circuit court judges look at the FDCPA and come up with these, you know, crazy theories that go so beyond what the statute says. It's, you know, it's refreshing to see that the Supreme Court, even the liberals on the court for the most part, have looked at the statute very narrowly. And, you know, thankfully for that. But it's just, it's unfortunate that we have to go all the way to the top court in the country to get some logic to it should be a pretty simple statute.
Yeah, but I think what happens, Joanne, and this is, I think, pretty common, is you find a judge that's going to say, well, this seems sort of unfair, right?
I get it. I totally get it.
And my dad would call them activist judges, for sure, because the statute is very simple. And you know, you gotta love Judge Thomas, because he always is like, the text states an action may be brought within 1 year from the date on which the violation occurs.
Right.
End of story. But then you have, you know, and I think you see this in Ginsburg's dissent, and you know, perhaps even in Sotomayor's concurrence, where they're sort of talking generally about this idea that, you know, if the consumer doesn't know that the violation happened because of some malfeasance, something that wasn't fair, that seemed fraudulent on behalf of the creditor, then it would make sense to apply the discovery rule and allow the consumer to bring the case when, you know, within 1 year from when they discover the violation, when, you know, the violation was in some way hidden from them because, you know, as in this case, they kept trying to say, well, you know, they served the guy at a house they knew he didn't live at to a person that they knew didn't look like the defendant or the plaintiff, rather.
Yeah, and with the discovery rule and fraud, and you just brought it up, I think, perfectly and with clarity, and it's similar to what the district court was saying as far as their consideration, the denial of any form also of equitable tolling, which I'm sure we'll get into later. But there was no allegation of any active misleading. Although the First Amendment complaint was amended, it wasn't really plausibly pled. So there wasn't anything misleading on the part of the defendants regarding the facts. And the way the court says, and I agree with this, is that the claims that amount to active misleading are exactly the same actions that form the basis of the alleged violation of the FDCPA. And the district court found that to be implausible.
Right. Yeah, they're at least suggesting that you'd have to go out and do something more to affirmatively, fraudulently conceal.
Right.
But I actually want to disagree a little bit with the assessment of whether the court's acting in a liberal or conservative manner here. It seems to me that what we often get are judges looking at statutes in two broad categories. We call punitive statutes and compensatory statutes, and punitive statutes are supposed to be construed narrowly. Compensatory statutes can be construed liberally. Case law has indicated that the FDCPA is allegedly not a punitive statute. I'm not sure I agree with that, but that's what the case law suggests. So that would allow for some measure of broad statutory interpretation. I think this is not so much a case of broad statutory interpretation versus narrow. I think it's just simply a complete failure of lower courts to apply rules of statutory construction that are longstanding. You know, the lower courts have simply been disregarding fundamental rules of interpretation of statutes, one of which is you start with the text of the statute. And the Supreme Court has made it clear that's where they're starting. I think that's what they did in Midland v. Johnson. Mm-hmm. In this case, they apply another rule, which is to look at what Congress has said elsewhere and assume that when Congress says something in one place and doesn't in another, the court should assume there's a reason for the distinction. Although they refer, I think, in this decision, the Thomas decision refers to the Credit Repair Organizations Act, he could just as easily have looked at the Fair Credit Reporting Act, which is also a part of the Consumer Credit Protection Act and contains an explicit discovery rule. Mm-hmm. What the lower court should have said was, Congress put a discovery rule in the FCRA. It would have been great if they'd done one in the FDCPA. They didn't. We have no choice. There's no discovery rule. And that's essentially what the Supreme Court has had to do, because the lower courts will not apply these traditional rules of construction when looking at FDCPA cases.
And so you're not chalking that up to active judging because they feel bad in some part for the consumer?
The difficulty is activist judges can get to the same result and apply the rules of statutory construction if they want. I mean, yes, there is a measure of activist judging going on. I mean, you get the same problem in other areas like Norr-Pennington, where they somehow think that an act of Congress overrides the Constitution of the United States. But nevertheless, I think that had the lower courts found even a half-assed way of getting at it, applying proper rules of statutory construction, you could look at the other cases and say, okay, I don't agree, but at least I see how they got there. I don't even see how you can get there. Mm-hmm. And yes, liberal to the extent it is result oriented. I dislike the liberal versus conservative terminology because activist or liberal judges are those who disregard the traditional rules no matter which way they rule. And sometimes they can rule for our side and sometimes they can rule for the other side. I think that they're screwing up no matter which direction they go. They should be following these rules.
Okay, excellent start. At this point, I just want to pause the discussion briefly and talk a little bit about the sponsor for today's webinar, TCN. TCN is a leading provider of cloud-based call center technology for enterprises, contact centers, BPOs, and collection agencies worldwide. Founded in 1999, TCN combines a deep understanding of the needs of call center users with a highly affordable delivery model, ensuring immediate access to robust call center technology such as predictive dialer, IVR, call recording, and business analytics required to optimize operations and adhere to TCPA regulations. It's always-on cloud-based delivery model provides customers with immediate access to the latest version of the TCN solution, as well as the ability to quickly and easily scale and adjust to evolving business needs. TCN serves various Fortune 500 companies and enterprises in multiple industries, including newspaper, collection, education, healthcare, automotive, political, customer service, and marketing. TCN is engaged and actively involved in understanding TCPA changes and how it is changing the industry. TCN regularly speaks to local and national leaders to help educate them on matters of TCPA and compliance for the betterment of the industry as a whole. For more information, please visit www.tcn.com. Thanks again to TCN for sponsoring today's webinar. We've got a couple of questions here from the audience. Let me take the first one. Let's see here. While settling the issue of whether the discovery rule applies to calculate the statute of limitations, the case leaves open the question of when the violation occurs. In letter cases, it seems pretty well settled that the violation occurs when the debt collector places the letter in the mail, that being the last time the debt collector can correct the error. But where the violation consists of filing a lawsuit, the circuits are divided. Some say the violation occurs when the debt collector files a lawsuit because it is the last time the debt collector can correct the error. Others say that it is when the consumer gets served with process. Does that mean that if the consumer is never served, then the violation never becomes right? I feel sure that consumers bar will not be willing to concede that point. So does the panel have any thoughts on when we'll get a ruling on when the violation occurs, especially in a case where the violation consists of filing a lawsuit against the consumer?
This is Scott. I'll try to unpackage that. So to go with more of the collection litigation aspect of it, I think it's important to describe the distinction here that we're working with. So with equitable tolling, it's describing a doctrine that pauses or tolls the limitation period after it's commenced. So it's only used really in extraordinary circumstances, and the litigant only qualifies really where there's been some type of pursuit of the rights diligently, and also some form of, let's say, something stood in the consumer's way, in the debtor's way, of preventing them from, let's say, timely filing an answer. The fraud-based discovery rule, though, sets the time at which a claim accrues. So it actually sets the time when the statute of limitation commences to run. So in that example that was just given, if, let's say, the process server was directed, and again, just an allegation that the process server, a plausible allegation, the process server was directed by the debt collector law firm to commit sewer service, well, potentially there would be a fraud-based discovery rule. Potentially also equitable tolling would come into play if it was plausibly pled that the creditor's attorney instructed the process server to, let's say, commit sewer service. That would be one example of how that would come into play.
Okay. Anyone else want to tackle their or share that? Share their thoughts? Nope.
So okay. I fall under perspective as follows. So first of all, with regard to the question, it assumes that a letter violation occurs when the letter is sent. There's actually some cases that say if it's the initial letter and you've, let's say, left some information out, there's case law that would say that limitations runs 5 days after the initial communication with the consumer, because that was the true deadline to give the disclosures required by the act. With regard to the lawsuit that's filed and never served, that's the tree that fell in the woods that no one heard mm-hmm. fall. I'm not sure you can make a case for a claim if you've never served it and no one knew about it and just sort of found it later under the Spokio case. I think that the Supreme Court might have a problem with there being subject matter jurisdiction. The real problem, and this is frankly an issue for the industry as a whole to work on, is we have two different systems of filing and serving lawsuits. The states where we file a lawsuit and then serve it, and the states where you serve it and then file. And the served and file states, that procedure creates a host of complications that would be really nice to see go away if the industry could figure out how to lobby through getting rid of serve then file process. And Joanne, Scott, Kelly, I don't know if any of you've had any experience with serve then file states, but I find the litigation and the limitations analysis in those jurisdictions to be just a royal mess.
Yeah, I agree with that. And also, even just back to the scenario that was given, you know, if in fact there was a discovery though of the lawsuit later on due to a default judgment, and just going back to the facts here, if let's say somebody applied for a mortgage and they learned there was a default judgment and it was because of sewer service that was directed by the attorney, then I think even under the Spokio decision, the fraud-based discovery rule could potentially come into play. But you would have to have that discovery of the fraud. Without the discovery of the fraud, there can't be the fraud-based discovery rule.
It was interesting during oral argument. Justice Breyer sort of ran through a litany of examples of different types of discovery rules, citing an opinion from Judge Posner that sort of aggregated all the various versions of the discovery rule. And the two that jumped out are the ones you see in the opinion, one of which is fraudulent concealment, someone going out of their way to commit some sort of fraud to conceal or deceive the offense. Conceal the offense or deceive the debtor. There's a classic case involving not this theory, but another one, where the lawyer goes to court and says to the debtor, "Oh, don't worry, you can go home. I'll dismiss the suit." And the debtor leaves, and then the lawyer files a default judgment request and gets a judgment. And the Court of Appeals refused to allow application of the normal rule that federal courts can't stand as courts of appeal of state court judgments. That's the sort of behavior that would be a fraudulent behavior that the courts won't tolerate. They're not going to allow, in that case, the Rooker-Feldman doctrine, but in this case, the simple limitations doctrine to apply. Equitable tolling, the thing that I think got bandied about during the argument, and I think it concerns things like an earthquake, an act of terrorism, a 9/11. And defense counsel wisely said he was not taking on equitable tolling in his position. I think trying to argue to a court that if there's a disaster of any kind, that people should be barred from bringing their lawsuits is a losing position to take. Mm-hmm. And so defense counsel in this case was able to narrow the focus of his case to simply true traditional discovery rule situations. Someone says what you're describing, Scott, the difference between the situation where someone just simply says, "Hey, I didn't know about it," versus the one where someone deliberately takes affirmative steps to keep the debtor from knowing what happened.
Yeah, I agree. And the defense counsel was also very wise for not discussing it, because it really wasn't discussed by the Supreme Court in the decision, because Rutkiski failed to preserve the issue, as the Third Circuit also found. So I agree that it was a smart decision to avoid discussing the equitable tolling issue.
There's another question that came in. What effect do you think this case will have on the continuing violation theory as it relates to the statute of limitations? can hear all the wheels turning.
Joanne, didn't you get caught up in some of that? The continuing violation?
I was going to say, I mean, you know, the continuing violation theory is not accepted in every circuit. The Third Circuit, I think, has rejected it. I don't think it has any, I mean, it was not directly discussed in this case. I don't see any impact. I mean, there just hasn't been any kind of resolution on that issue at all. So I think there's no impact on it. It hasn't been raised in many, I haven't seen it in a long time, but who knows?
Okay. We also got a question that was emailed in a couple of days ago that I wanted to ask before I forget. And the question is, it presents a few basic facts. The debt collector sues, believing the account is in statute. The defendant files an answer 30 days later, claiming the statute of limitations as a defense. The lawsuit is not decided until more than a year after, or sorry, until more than 1 year has elapsed. After the entry of judgment for the defendant in the collection matter, the defendant then files an FDCPA complaint within 1 year of the judgment entry. Questions, is this time barred? Should the consumer have filed a counterclaim to preserve the claim? Anyone want to take a crack at that?
So are you saying that the determination that the collection suit was filed out of stat was during the course of the litigation?
Let's see here. The debt collector sues, believing the account is in statute. The defendant files an answer 30 days later, claims the statute of limitations as a defense. The lawsuit is not decided until after more than 1 year has elapsed.
But it sounds like the judgment was in favor of the
consumer. But was it in favor because it was an out-of-stat claim?
That's what the key is.
Yeah, it sounds like we have like a collateral estoppel or even a Rooker-Feldman type issue. If there was judgment in favor of the creditor, then it would potentially, or even if it's for the defendant, if it's based on the statute of limitation, then there already would have been a determination by the state court. It wouldn't be ripe for the federal court to make a determination.
I think the concern is that the act of filing the suit past the statute, that is the claim itself, arises more than a year before the debtor knows definitively that he or she is right. And the question is the debtor required to file the FDCPA suit while the state court suit is still pending and before a determination on the limitations is run, just in order to preserve the statute? And I don't know where you guys come out. I would think that a competent consumer lawyer not wanting to risk malpractice is going to file that FDCPA suit before the 1 year runs. And good defense lawyers should probably go to the federal judge and say, hey, this thing's getting litigated in state court. We'd like you to stay.
Right.
And even if it was a pro se litigant, I would say that if there was an attempt to file an FDCPA case after or more than 1 year, I think it would be dismissed on those grounds. It would be out of statute, and it wouldn't be that it was something that was discovered. It wasn't the new injury. There's the claim here is that the consumer, let's say, didn't realize that whether or not it was or wasn't out of statute, which also is inconsistent with them using an affirmative defense that it was out of statute. So I think you have, no matter what, I'm looking at a dismissal.
Okay. For anybody who has a case, a statute of limitations case currently before a federal judge or a court of appeals. Kelly, you know, what advice would you give, or what, you know, how does this ruling affect those cases?
Well, it depends. So if, you know, the issue is just about whether or not the discovery rule applies or the one-year statute of limitations based on the plain reading of the FDCPA, you're in good shape because the Supreme Court has just found that the FDCPA statute of limitations is 1 year from the date when the violation occurs. But if there's an argument about when the violation occurred, which right. is going to be ultimately what it would turn into, then you might have different, decisions based on the circuit courts that have different opinions about that. What do the typical practitioners think?
I would agree with that, Kelly. I think what was resolved is that the statute of limitations for an FDCPA claim is what the statute says. But there's so many cases, and we've all experienced them in our careers, of what does it mean to calculate the appropriate statute of limitations when you want to file a collection suit? That has not been resolved. And it won't be resolved for a very long time because and the problem is that federal courts have sat as almost appellate judges in state court proceedings in trying to figure out what is the appropriate statute of limitations. I don't know, and that was, if you look at the amended complaint here, that was the underlying issue in the collection complaint was whether the Clem office filed the collection action within the statute of limitations. And there was an issue of whether Virginia law applied, but they were filing it in Pennsylvania. All that mess is still undecided.
And the other thing, and Joanne, I want to agree with you, to piggyback off of that, is the right. the corollary is that the consumer attorneys know how to frame the case, and they know how to plead a plausible allegation. So they'll right. read this decision just as we are. And see what the Supreme Court had to say and figure out, well, I can't rely on just using the discovery rule in general course. So I need to make sure that I firm up the facts or the factual allegations in order to make certain that maybe I could demonstrate some fraud or perhaps even the possibility of equitable tolling. But there are ways around, and I'm not saying it's right or not, but until I think courts are less reticent to use Rule 11 to demonstrate that there really should be, and there are consequences for filing objectively frivolous claims. And as long as the fee shifting provision under 1692K exists, I think again, it's going to motivate those that file these types of claims to figure out the best way to frame the facts.
So Mike, mind if I throw something at my fellow speakers?
Of course not. Go ahead.
Anyone have a concern that for the very reason Scott was just articulating, what this is going to do is generate a lot more accusations of conduct that, if true, would draw the attention of regulators or grievance committees? Because that seems to me to be the unintended consequence of this, is that there's now an incentive to go in and try to prove some sort of fraudulent concealment or bad mm-hmm. faith.
Or at least to allege it in the pleadings, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And even that allegation alone is something that on a Rule 12 standard, if it's plausibly pled, needs to be accepted as true for that purpose, at least.
And that's, thank you, Scott. That's the thing that worries me, is there is this shoot first, ask questions later approach in the industry of filing Rule 12b6 motions seeking dismissal, and the court is required to accept the allegations as true when you move to dismiss on the face of the pleadings, and that's just going to generate the orders that make it sound like people committed fraud even if they didn't.
Right. So then I think what you're saying here, as someone who works for an agency, is that the best practice for me to do when I get sued and I see those types of allegations in the pleadings is to make sure that I do not move to dismiss on a preliminary grounds, but instead actually wait, develop the facts so that I can show that there was no fraud whatsoever. And I think that if more people take that tack and do that, not just in this you know, discovery of the violation type case, you know, around a statute of limitations, but of the FDCPA, but really in many different areas of the FDCPA litigation, if more folks were able to just wait and, you know, bring a motion for summary judgment, we'd see a lot of decisions that are going to go in our favor. And I would think, you know, based on what Scott was saying, that if, you know, we're able to show, if it turns out that we do get a lot more pleadings that are alleging, you know, fraud and fraudulent behavior, those pleadings are taken really seriously. So if you can develop a record to show that there's really no basis in fact for those whatsoever, you're going to end up finding that courts will not have a lot of tolerance for them, but only if you take the right steps and develop the record appropriately.
I think these are all great recommendations, and I would agree with them, but unfortunately, I will speak for Scott, Manny, and myself, who represents defendants, and Kelly, you've been a defendant. You get a lawsuit that says, you know, you tried to serve me in 2011, and now it's 2019, and I'm filing a lawsuit against you, you know, from a cost-benefit analysis, of course, the first thing that you're going to do is say motion to dismiss. I mean, that's the most cost-effective way on its face to get rid of cases like this. I hear what you're saying, and maybe this case changes the discussion with your client. But, you know, clients are cost-stressed enough, they're cost-stressed enough just in operating their businesses when they get these lawsuits. You know, always the desire is, what can we do to get rid of this quickly if we're not going to settle? And when the facts on the pleading suggest a real gaping hole in a matter of time that would clearly indicate a, you know, you're past the statute of limitations, it's going to be a difficult ask of a client to devote a lot of resources to do discovery in situations like that. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, and this is Scott. I agree. There are clients, and for good reason, that are looking at this from a cost benefit analysis and saying, well, if we go forward with discovery, not only does that mean also that we're getting discovery from the plaintiff, the consumer, but also it means that we're opening ourselves up to all forms of discovery. And that's part of the equation as well, even in a case where a consumer attorney will file first and make all forms of allegations and establish the facts later. That's why sometimes the best way to go about it is to secure the position with a Rule 11 motion, if it truly is based on objectively frivolous grounds. There's a claim of fraud simply to get around a statute of limitation. That's where Rule 11 really does come in handy. And that's not something that's immediately filed with the court. It's something that allows for a 21-day safe harbor period. But it is another method of, I think, protecting our clients in those types of situations.
And what I would argue is the following. I think Scott and Joanne have correctly described the client thought process on cost savings. My reaction, though, is usually, and how expensive is a 12B6 loss that encourages more litigation? I tend to side with Kelly's view that developing facts is a good thing. Unfortunately, I have to fight the very fight that Joanne and Scott are discussing, which is clients trying to weigh which is the most cost-effective analysis. Yeah. I generally find it's easier for me to take a deposition and move for summary judgment with real facts in front of the judge and then take the chance that the judge says, well, I'm going to assume everything they say is true. If it is, it looks pretty bad for you. We've had a tremendous amount of bad case law in the collection industry resulting from 12B6 motions because judges had to decide that facts as pled were true solely for the purpose of determining a 12B6 motion. And so I think the defendants are having the exact discussion that Scott and Joanne describe, and I think they're making bad business decisions. They're trying to go for a quick short-term expenditure and a quick kill on what they get is an expensive case with a decision that hurts them and brings on more litigation.
And Manny, I want to say you're 100% right also about depositions. Typically, where we have a client that says, go for it, and we're able to get in there and do a deposition, a lot of the times plaintiffs don't even show up for their own case. And having discovery does prevent some really awful decisions from coming out where the facts are accepted as true. And it's for the purpose of the statute. The court isn't accepting the facts as true because they believe the facts. That's the standard under Rule 12. And that it's very easy for, let's say, the consumer bar to spin that case as being a victory on the merits when really it's more of a procedural victory.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So to all the law firms and agencies out there, really think critically about it. Before you choose to, file a motion to dismiss on the pleadings, really talk about it and think, because you can also spread out the costs. A lot of the great firms out there that represent us, including our folks on the phone, are willing to, spread out the costs and enter into different types of billing arrangements so that you can properly litigate the case. And if you're worried about, ultimately, probably you can get them to go away just by offering them something to settle and saving your money for your one big case.
Correct me if I'm wrong, please, and I'm sure everybody will. But in reading some of the comments, it seems to me like the attorneys for the petitioner seem to expect that other cases with similar circumstances may eventually make its way back to the Supreme Court again. This time they're projecting a potentially different outcome. Is that something that's a possibility? Is it something that we need to be sort of worried about on the radar, or is it just sort of more posturing than anything else?
This is Joanne. I think it's posturing. I mean, it's very, as we all know, it's very, 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 very difficult to get a case to the Supreme Court. I mean, you need a body of case law of which there's a circuit split. And even with a circuit split, it has to be an issue in which the court is, willing to listen. They take, I know my Supreme Court nerds on the phone may know a little bit more than me. I mean, how many cases do they take in a year?
It's 3% of everything that comes in. Yeah.
Right. And how many writs of certiorari are filed? Hundreds upon thousands. Yeah.
I was going to say, back when I worked at the Supreme Court, I was a tour guide. I think it was like 8,000, and that was in the 90s.
Right. So, that would not be my worry right now. There's a lot of other FDCPA issues that may creep its way to the Supreme Court, hopefully. I was really surprised that they took this case, happy that they did, but kind of surprised. There's so many other splits. I mean, Kelly, as you know, with Graziano and all those cases that are percolating, there's real issues, real issues with some of the aspects of the FDCPA. And let's not forget, folks, we've got a final rule hopefully coming out in May or some first quarter, second quarter of 2020. There's going to be, potential challenges to that. So I think the Supreme Court docket, at least in the near future, is full of many other FDCPA issues rather than this one.
Okay, excellent. A reminder to everybody, if you have a question for our panel on this case or something related, type it into your Q&A panel on your Zoom webinar control panel, and we'll get to it before the end of the discussion. Also wanted to remind everybody that this webinar is being sponsored by TCN. Thanks again to them. I'm curious, and I think I know the answer, but I'm going to ask the question anyway, because maybe it'll start a discussion. Joanne, you mentioned the proposed rule from the CFPB. Does anybody think that there'll be anything sort of in a final rule that may address this now that this has come out after the proposed rule, or will there be any movement to have Congress amend the FDCPA to address this issue? Do you think that this is something that is going to be looked at by the CFPB or Congress, or is it something that's just going to be left for the Supreme Court to sort of finally rule on?
I think they're going to leave it alone. This is Kelly.
Yeah.
I think they're just going to, you know, the plane, it wasn't addressed in, you know, either the Sbrefa proposal or the final proposal that came out. So I think they're going to let sleeping dogs lie. Supreme Court just ruled, plain text wins the day. I don't think we'll see anything.
I'm not even sure they could do anything with the rules. There's a difference between deciding whether a court has the power to hear the case and deciding how portions of the act are implemented in daily practice. I'm not really persuaded the Bureau could change the rule and put in a definition of, I'm just not sure they can insert a discovery rule. I think that requires legislative action.
It would. You're right.
The only thing that I guess, and this wouldn't be through the Bureau, but through Congress, would be to increase the statute of limitation or increase the limitation period. And I'm not aware of that happening.
No. In all of the amendments that have been, come up, and it's funny, we had an every 10 years cycle that has been broken, but you had amendments in 86, 96, and 2006. And I don't recall a discovery rule proposal in any of the legislation that was being bandied about during any of those changes.
Okay, it's excellent. Go ahead.
There's a point that Scott and Joanne were making earlier, though, that really goes to one of the questions you had, Mike, and it's simply this. Look, this kind of issue may get to the Supreme Court again. The question is going to be who wants to pay for that.
Right.
And by the way, all three of us will be glad to volunteer to be the people who get paid if someone wants to pay one of us to do it, because I can tell you the cost of doing one of these cases at the Supreme Court, just getting there is obscene. You've got to get to a decision in a trial court, a decision in a court of appeals, do all of the briefing for the Supreme Court, do all the argument prep, get through all of that. This is so substantial an expense, it's sort of like another issue that affects the industry that one of my clients asked me about recently. And he said, why aren't we litigating that? I said, because you declined to pay us $250,000 to have the fight. He said, oh, yeah, that's a good reason. and that same doctrine applies here, is that whoever wants to make law on this had better recognize you're going to pay a lot of money to do that. The real hope here should be that the lower courts take the message from the Supreme Court and start interpreting the statute the way the Supreme Court keeps telling them it needs to be interpreted.
I would agree with that. I think, and I think it has to be an argument when we face a lot of these cases, both in the district and the circuit court, these very expansive, I'll call them bizarre interpretations, clearly in my mind doesn't seem that's what Congress intended. And it's not, and the Supreme Court, which is the court of the land, is interpreting Congress's intent with the statute as well. So, I mean, there's just got to be pushback on that. And it's been unfortunate. And I understand the fairness issue. And there are a lot of times facts, are egregious where a court feels that they are encumbered to do something. But Congress also could have written a better statute, and they didn't. And that's been evident in a lot of the concurring opinions, certainly that you saw in Obudzki and others, that have really looked to Congress and say, you know, go fix it. It is what it is, and we're bound by it. And I find that very telling.
So I say probably the most important question for people working at agencies listening. I'd say the most important question for the last one, and that is, what changes, if any, should collection agencies make to their policies, procedures, operations as a result of this ruling? Is there anything that they should or need to be doing differently now that they weren't doing a week ago?
This is Scott, and I'll see if anyone disagrees or perhaps agrees. I don't think it's really the type of decision that necessarily impacts current policies and procedures. But I would certainly use it as I like to with cases to go back and confirm that policies and procedures, let's say, are up to date. with respect to limitations on, let's say, bringing collection suits and even on collections, which was really the primary basis when you go back to the district court case or the collection case to begin with. And these are state-specific inquiries, so it's of great importance to stay up to date, especially if collecting in multiple jurisdictions. And I guess the only other point is to go back to the, again, the initial factual allegations, which is the genesis of this lawsuit, is service of process. And in states where service of process is by private individuals, not a constable, whether or not a license is necessary and whether or not required, we generally recommend that process servers handling high volume claims should have some form of digital impression of the service attempt. And I'll give one example briefly. Like here in New York City, a licensed process server has to take a picture of the property, and the picture has to be contemporaneously deposited into an independent server with a time and date stamp, with a geosite enabled. And that's very much helped, I think, the collection industry in demonstrating the viability of the statute start date and as well as the service of process.
I would agree with you, Scott. First of all, I mean, Manny and I were both involved in this well over a decade ago. I mean, the issue, I don't see issues of sewer service. Now, maybe they exist, and certainly a decade ago, it was a problem. It seems to me that industry has done a really, really good job in elevating their game and doing and implementing the processes and procedures, Scott, that you have articulated. Of course, there's always going to be instances of bad service, but I don't see it as being as prevalent as it was many, many years ago. I don't know from this case whether, I mean, it's Pennsylvania. I don't know whether it was Philadelphia or one of the counties. I don't know whether this was a private process server or not, or whether it was a constable or a writ server or whatever. But clearly, Mike, to answer your question, I think what agencies or law firms need to do is to go back and check their oversight policies and procedures with their process servers to ensure that they are doing what they're doing. And, you know, my experience over the last several years is it's very detailed. They have a lot of procedures in place to ensure that that mistakes are, you know, not prevalent. But, you know, the ironic thing is I've seen instances of, you know, court-appointed process servers or whatever their titles are who do really bad service. But somehow, because it's court appointed, it's okay. You know, I'm not so sure about that. So, yeah, I mean, I think just maybe a reevaluation of those policies and procedures, making sure that the communication is well intended. And, you know, there's allegations in the amended complaint that, you know, the Clem firm directed the process server, you know, to engage in bad service. I mean, that's a pretty significant allegation. We never got to the point to really litigate it, but certainly you want to make sure that your documentation doesn't reflect something like that.
And I can tell you, I've been dealing with attorney general investigations dealing with process service for a fair number of years. Looking at process service, not just at the vendor level, but at the individual server level, looking for anomalies, having a good tracking system, a good investigative system, recognizing the difference between someone who draws a complaint, but a court finds it's invalid, and starting to ask why it is you've got the same person who's on three different cases where service was found to be improper. Becomes very important when you're answering questions from a regulator. If you've got a good tracking system in place and can explain why you've done what you've done, you're already way ahead of where you want to be.
Okay, well, we've just got a couple of minutes left, given the expertise on the panel, I want to give each of them a chance to sort of share any parting words of wisdom, any takeaways, anything they didn't get a chance to address today but wanted to, just because the discussion didn't head that way. If they want to talk about their holiday plans, you know, New Year's resolutions, you know, best cookie recipe, whatever they want to share in the remaining time we have. Wanted to give everybody a chance to do so. Kelly, we'll let you go first.
So I will just answer the question for those who work at agencies that are not law firms, and say that I don't think there's much you can do with your policies and procedures, or much to do as a result of this particular decision. So that's that. But it is a good one. And it's great when we see the Supreme Court taking a very common sense approach to a really simple statute and a very simple portion of the statute. So exciting news all around. I'm going on Wednesday to hear Manny's son play lead principal viola in the American Ballet Theater's production of The Nutcracker. So I'm very excited about that. And I wish you all a merry holiday.
Thank you very much, Manny.
Well, I will put in a pitch for agencies and law firms on this one. Ask really good questions. Collectors are always telling people what to do, but the more information that your employees can gather, especially since everybody records these days, the better off you are. And I can tell you, we've had cases we were able to defend because a good, smart collector asked questions that showed that the cause of action was known to the plaintiff more than a year before the lawsuit was filed. Your employees are your first line of defense, and the better they are at asking questions and gathering information, the better off you are. And I will also wish everybody a wonderful holiday. I hope you get some time off in the next few weeks.
Awesome. Excellent. Thank you. Joanne?
Thanks, Mike. And thanks to my panelists. Always fun to chat with you all. I agree with Kelly. It's a win. I think we need to be reminding courts when we are involved in these cases, and even regulators when we're involved in these cases. I mean, we've got to look at the FDCPA for what it is. It is meant to prevent abuse, but at the same time, it is not supposed to competitively disadvantage those debt collectors, whether they are actual debt collectors or attorneys, when they are doing the right thing. Unfortunately, and we see this all the time with the FDCPA does not integrate well with state law, as we have seen. And, you know, every state has different rules about what is appropriate service of process. And while we, you know, there were many years in New York, Scott, you can tell me whether this still exists. It was, you know, you just post it to the door. That was service. I think that has changed over the years. But if you're following the rules and, you know, service of process rules in states can be murky and not very enforceful and vague. But if you're otherwise complying with that, that should not nonetheless be an FDCPA violation. But unfortunately, we see that all the time. So as we've indicated, a good time to maybe sit down with your process server now that we're hitting in 2020. Go over their procedures. Make sure your communication with them is coherent. Make sure you're reviewing the affidavits. They look appropriate. And let's make sure that consumers do get their due process, because that is important.
Awesome. Excellent. Scott, I reserve the last word for you, because you were the person who came to me with this awesome idea to do this webinar. So thank you for that. And you get to close us out today.
And you're welcome. First, I'll respond to Joanne. There is actually a fix and nail provision in the CPLR here in New York, but it can only be used if personal delivery, if you're unable to personally deliver or deliver to a person of suitable age and discretion. And there has to be multiple attempts before nail a mail. But to go back to what you said, if you start seeing a trend developing with, let's say, a certain server where it's showing out as an outlier that a majority or a higher percentage are by nail and mail, that would be something to look at and be cognizant of. But back to this case, I think it's a great victory for the industry. But as we all saw with Spokio, where the term intangible injury was used, pretty much any ambiguity that can be found in this case, and the biggest is going to be, I think, the way that the discovery rule is interpreted, especially with if there is fraud or an allegation of fraud involved, I should say, and equitable tolling. So there's a lot to look at. There's a lot to parse out. But we should really be aware if we start seeing cases that come through where there's all types of claims of fraud or anything else to prolong the statute. That's something that you should definitely speak to your attorneys about, because there are certain remedies for that. And happy holidays.
Excellent. Well, thank you. Before I let everyone go, I want to thank Kelly, Joanne, Manny, and Scott one more time for their insights today. Really appreciate them taking the time out of their busy schedule on very short notice to share their perspective on an important development in the ARM industry. Also want to thank TCN one more time for sponsoring today's webinar. Please go to www.tcn.com to learn more about the company. Thanks to everybody who participated today. A final reminder to please take a minute and fill out the feedback survey. And if you're looking for a copy of the recording for this webinar, it should be posted to accountsrecovery.net webinar recordings page probably by tomorrow. Panel, awesome job. Thank you so much. Have a great rest of the day.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Thanks. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays.